If you missed it live, catch the broadcast on kaya959.co.za.
So you may have noticed President Cyril Ramaphosa was in Rwanda over the past weekend alongside other dignitaries from other parts of the world. And Rwanda was commemorating 30 years since the genocide there in Rwanda. So it was on the 6th of April 1994 when that evening Rwanda saw what was really what I would imagine as a total nightmare for the next 100 days. Advocate Kennedy Gihana is a human rights lawyer and a Rwandan genocide survivor who's on the line with us. A very good evening, and thank you very much, Advocate Gihana, for making time for us. Welcome to Point of View.
No, thank you very much for inviting me. Actually, let me first correct you. I'm an attorney, I'm not an advocate. But it is fine.
Oh, we apologize for that. We will definitely remove that. We apologize for that. I do want us to talk a little bit about your history, which will obviously lead us and segue us into this very important time that this weekend Rwanda was commemorating 30 years since that genocide. You were born in Rwanda. And just tell us a little bit about your background there as a young person.
Actually, I was not born in Rwanda. I was born in Uganda, but we went back. So, but my parents were there. My relatives, yeah. So they were caught there.
So you were not born in Rwanda. You were born in Uganda and then came to Rwanda.
Yes, our parents took refugee in 1959. Mm-hmm. That was the so-called the Hutu Revolution against the kingdom, which Rwanda was kingdom by that time. Mm-hmm. So the Hutu majority, so they were not happy with the kingdom, and then they overthrew the kingdom, and then they installed the republic, the president. Because most of the people in the kingdom or the king and his subject were all Tutsis. So that's where majority of the Tutsis found themselves hard to seek refuge in a different part of the world, especially neighboring countries.
Which is where you were born, but your parents were Rwandan citizens.
Yeah, no, definitely, yes. Gotcha. They left in 1959, yeah.
Okay. And obviously then you came back as a family back into Rwanda.
Yes. That was the early 80s, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And things were already starting to look a little bit tense. Give us a sense of how you remember those days.
Yeah, no, it's actually, it's, every tragedy or the war, they are all the same. So after 1959, when there was that overthrow of the king of the kingdom, then the Hutu majority took power and they segregated the Tutsi. So they remained on power until 1994, when we Tutsis who were outside the country. Under the leadership of General Paul Kagame, mm-hmm. We overthrew the government in Rwanda, the so-called genocide government. Mm-hmm. So, and we installed also the Tutsi government, which is ruled by, they are ruling until now from 1994.
Yeah, so. And I want us to unpack that a little bit, because that fateful day on the 6th of April 1994, what actually, I suppose, sparked it, and you'll correct us if we're wrong, is the shooting down of a plane that the president was in.
Yeah, I'm struggling to hear you. Your voice is low, but if I think you asked about the shooting down of the airplane.
Yes, I'm saying if you can give us the context of what sparked, what was the actual spark that night on 6th of April 1994?
Up to now, that is debatable, even though there's some evidence that the ruling RPF the Rwandese Patriotic Front, which had the military wing led by Paul Kagame, it has been stated by different people who are close to him or the people who are inside the RPF or RPA, which is Rwandese Patriotic Army, which now is the government army, actually, he's the one who ordered the shooting down of aeroplane because he didn't want to go to the election, because you should remember that this gentleman, the president, Habyarimana, was coming from Arusha, and there was an agreement to have a transition government, which he was going to lead until, together with RPF until the election. So definitely, Kagame could, the RPF could not stand. They could not have... they could not succeed. So, based on the evidence and the people who were close to him, who are giving the testimony or the evidence, they are saying that if they were to go to the election, they could not make it because the Hutu, they make it 85%. So there was no chance that the RPF could get even enough seats in the parliament. So that's why they had decided to shoot down to take a power by force, which happened, unfortunately.
You were in that army, were you not?
Yes, I was.
And how old were you at the time?
17, 18.
Do you remember your recruitment into the army?
I was recruited as all other younger kids. Had even kids who were 15 years. The reason majority of us joined that because that they were telling us that, look, we have been in exile, our parents have been in exile for a long time. They were segregated, they were not allowed to come back in the country, so we have to come and fight the Hutu regime and bring democracy, have rule of law. Unfortunately, after the death of millions of Rwandese, not only Tutsis, actually, that term of actuality has been changed recently here. If you check even American, they are still calling it the Rwandan genocide, not the Tutsi genocide, because if you check, the Tutsi genocide is used as a tool, it is a practical tool to expose to have leverage so that they can remain on power. So, there are so many Hutus who died during genocide. There are so many Tuas, even if they make 1%, who died. So the current regime, the military regime in Kigali, they don't want those people to be mentioned. And the reason is because of the political reason. You can see that's why you see they have extended the hand of invading Congo in the pretense of protecting the people who speak in Rwanda, in Congo.
If you may, I would like us to take us to that day for you and how it panned out for you as a young person in that army and how you knew that, you were right in the middle of a civil war.
I joined 1992.
Yes.
Early 1992, because the river movement started in 1990, October. So most of the things which happened, even though I was more a younger boy and I was on the low rank, so I had no much information, but I could see what was happening. All these killings and the death and the revenge, so I could see it, yes.
And do you remember the day, the 6th of April? Do you remember distinctly what happened on that day?
Yeah, I still remember because we were put on a standby. I think almost 2 days.
You were already on standby before the 6th?
Yes, we started on the 4th. To be on standby, march towards the Kigali, but we thought probably is the war, because there was already tension.
Yes.
So we didn't know what was going to happen. Actually, when the aeroplane was shot down, I think at around 7 o'clock at night, in the evening, we are given a marching order from the eastern part of a place called Byumba in Ruhengeri. It's the northern part of Rwanda. So we were given an order which was bordering with Uganda. So we had to march. We started marching on that evening on 6 after the shooting down of the airplane.
And were you aware that there was already movement, by the other side, the rebel group, that they were already starting to kill civilians?
No, the civilian, after the genocide, or the Hutus, or the government troops, or the people, the Hutus started retaliating against the Tutsi citizen. It started on the day of the shooting down on the 6th, when it was announced that the airplane of the president it was shut down. So you should remember that that gentleman, President Habyarimana, was on power for a long time also, and the citizens saw, they were seeing him as their savior, as their father. So they retaliated against Tutsis because they thought that Tutsis inside the country supporting the rebel group, which were Tutsis.
And of course, the slaughter started of the Tutsis. And as you're saying, it's very difficult because it almost felt like a counter action by the Hutus, who felt that they were bereaved by the death of the president.
And you see, it's unfortunately that it happened that way. I think for all negotiations were taken to be serious, I don't think that we could have seen what happened. Anyway, of course, the people were dying left here and there because of the fighting between the two groups, the government and the rebel groups. But to that scale, I don't think that we could have reached to that stage, to the stage of killing almost 1 million people.
You lost some family members in that civil war.
Yes.
Well, did you know at the time that some of your family members, had been killed? When did you find out?
No, I came to find out later when I went to, because I went to see if there is a relative who remained. Unfortunately, I knew, because the area where we are coming from, it was predominated the Tutsi, so I knew that there is no one who was left there.
Your own experience during that 100 days, just take us through that.
It is terrible. It is terrible to go back. But you still have a memory of what you saw. So it is a difficult, and it is not me alone. That there is any Rwandan who didn't lose any relative. I think majority of the Rwandans, whether you are inside the country or you are not inside the country or outside the country, majority of them, they had relatives, they have extended families. So everybody in Rwanda was actually lost one person or two or the entire family. So it's not me alone.
Of course.
And it is not easy for, especially this time of the year, to go through all this,
Absolutely.
Yeah. But we march on.
Do you think at the time you had full appreciation of what the war was about, apart from, of course, when you are in the army of a particular group, you may have been, brought up with a certain kind of a political message. Do you think you fully appreciated what was actually going on?
I don't think that when you are such young and also you are not in leadership, you are a charged soldier, a foot soldier. You take whatever they tell you. But all what we are told is that we are liberating our country. We are going back. We want freedom. We want democracy. We want everyone to have education, to have free speech, to have all the democratic values like any other country. So that was making us, some of us, and also to be told that our parents or the people have been were marginalized for a long time, So, and that's why even now, if you go to Rwanda and you talk about, you talk to Tutsi, they still see the Rwandese as enemy, even though they cannot. The government has suppressed that. The Hutus cannot, because if the Hutu talks, they call him a genocide. They imprison or they kill him. You can see there is no, in Rwanda, no one can demonstrate. Even if you are grieved, you cannot demonstrate unless the government calls people to come on the street. But you, as a citizen, you cannot demonstrate. Secondly, you cannot, the Hutus cannot create political parties. Those one who tried it, you know what happened to Ingabire and the other Hutus who tried to create political parties. So you can see that all the military top leadership, they are Tutsis. There is no Hutu. So don't think that the Hutus, they are happy, but they don't have any voice, because there is that heavy burden of them being called the genociders. Because you had even recently, I think a few years ago, the president said that all kids of Hutus must be asking forgiveness for the crime of their parents. So every Hutu is a genocider. If you are still young, they call you to be having the genocider jury. So that's it is the weapon which the current government, the military regime in Rwanda, is using to remain in power as much as they can.
I'm in conversation with Kennedy Gihana, who is a human rights lawyer and a Rwandan genocide survivor. He is currently living in South Africa, in exile in South Africa. We'll talk about those reasons. But he was part of the army at the time that liberated the Tutsis while that genocide was happening. 100 days later, that killing of the Tutsis and some moderate Hutus as well, that started on the 6th of April 1994. I'm very happy to take calls from you on 086-000-0959. You can also send a voice note on 063-688-0959. We're having this conversation because this weekend marked 30 years after the genocide in Rwanda.
Point of View.
Monday to Thursday, 8 to 10 p.m.
30 years after genocide in Rwanda, we're reflecting on that. It's important because one, you know, sometimes takes for granted what we have here. And if we're not careful, so easy for us to lose everything that we have. So history is very important in teaching us how to safeguard some of our freedoms and some of what we have, the peace that we've managed to get in this country for the past 30 years. So I'm in conversation with Kennedy Gihana, who is a human rights lawyer and Rwandan genocide survivor, who at the time, he says, quite a young man, but was in the army that was fighting the Hutus who actually had started slaughtering people. I mean, it's an estimated 800,000 minority Tutsis and the moderate Hutus were killed in the 100 days. And of course, this particular army brought this to an end. It is a difficult time, as he says, you know, this time of the year is usually not an easy time to reflect on this. He himself lost some family members there. Thank you again, Kennedy, for affording us the time and your story.
No, thanks.
You mentioned the fact that it's a very difficult time to reflect on this at this time. And I know we are told that Rwanda is very somber at this time. No real sport or music played on broadcasting platforms, a requirement for stillness. And, that the flags are flying half-mast. It's a very difficult time for anybody in Rwanda at the moment, and especially citizens, even those who are not in Rwanda.
Yes, that's true. It is the policy of the government, and you see, genocide has become a political tool is no longer time to sit down and the people reflect to what happened to the nation and try to build the country, like what happened here in South Africa. What happened here, the people fought for the freedom, and the people in 1994, they attained history, I mean, the freedom. They created a constitution, which everybody is under. So, which is different from Rwanda. When genocide happened, what we call the victor justice played a big role to be where we are now.
The international tribunal that was set up in Tanzania, did it work? In your view, was it effective?
Not at all. There is no way. That's where I was going, actually, to tell you that where in any war, when there is a conflict and the one wins that war, or he calls it to win, take over power, he tried to oppress those he has defeated. So it is difficult for to say that the Rwandan tribunal, the tribunal for Rwanda, the one which was in Arusha, did any job, because what they did, they rounded up only the people from one side, but the whole of the tribunal, the way it was drafted or created, it was to try all the people who committed not only genocide but also on the side on the side of the RPF. So what did the RPF, because it was already in power, they protected their people. So the people who were brought before the tribunal, they were people from the one side which was defeated. So it didn't help at all.
Because as you're saying, I mean, this was a war, so it was complicated. It's not only one side that committed crimes, it's both sides.
Exactly. There is a lot of documented killings by the RPF, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, the UN report. So many people, the RPF also killed the Hutus on the way. And those massacres and the killings, they were war crimes, but those war crimes were not prosecuted up to now.
The community courts that were set up, in your view, were those effective?
They could have been effective if they were used to reconcile people. But you don't release people, you arrest people, you don't know whether this one actually... Because what happened after genocide, all Hutu's men were all rounded up. There was no evidence. As long as you were Hutu, put in jail. That's what was happening in 1994, 1995, 1996. Yes, and our day, I could see it. So you can't know who was guilty and who was not guilty. But we can't just say that all Hutus, because they were Hutus, they all participated. Don't deny that they participated in the genocide. They did. But we can't say that all of them, they did. So even if because there were many people, there is no way the government could have tried them. So only the solution to alleviate the overcrowding of the prison, they had to release them. But the way they released them, they also not help them to reconcile with the people, because we don't have the truth and reconciliation. There was no truth and reconciliation like here, what happened here, so that the both sides of the truths and the Hutus can sit down and talk, and the government and the international community help them to have that truth and reconciliation, and so that those who are found to have committed all these crimes, both sides can be brought to book. That never happened.
It's interesting speaking to an insider, because I would have regarded you as an insider at the time. You then required to go to the Congo. What was a tipping point for you? Because you then decided, enough of this war, I'm out. What was it that made you believe you no longer wanted to be part of fighting your other members of your country, other people in your country, and fighting on behalf of your country as well in another land.
You see, when I was at school, when I went to join the movement, the only thing what made me to join, first was that is to bring democracy, the rule of law, and the people can be free, and also to solve this problem once for all of the refugees. So that when all refugees were outside the country, if they come inside the country, we will sit down and build the nation and be one person. But when we reached in Rwanda, after the killings, and seeing what was happening left and right, both sides, when the genocide happened, and they see also the one who have just captured the country. If you see what was happening, I don't think that it was something which was what led me to fight or to join the liberation, because we lost 1 million people.
Mm.
Almost 3-4 million people, they were refugees in Congo, in Burundi, they took refuge in Tanzania. So all those were Hutus. So instead of making the conducive environment for them to come back, in 1996, General Kagame decided to invade Congo to go and kill. If we check the mapping report,
yes,
of 2010, I don't know whether you have heard about it.
Yes, I have, yes.
And they said, if when they crossed the border, myself, that's when I refused to go.
Mm.
That, look, we captured the country, we are in Rwanda, there is no need of going to Congo. So that's, and some of us, not me alone, but some of us and the other younger kids, they refused. And some were imprisoned, those ones who didn't manage to escape. Because in the army, you cannot disobey the orders, you know.
Of course.
So, you are superior, you can't disobey them. So the turning point was when we had to go to Congo. And when we went to Congo, the intention was not only to force the refugees, 3 million Rwandan Hutus who were there, to come back. But the intention was to destroy their camps, the refugee camps there.
Mm.
And in the process, they went up to Kinshasa to remove the power, I mean Mr. Mobutu, from the prison,
mm-hmm.
where the current minister of the former minister of defense of Rwanda became the factory leader of Congo, Mr. General James Kabarebe, the special. He has made him now to be the minister of the region affairs, in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, but he, all these years he has been his secret advisor, General Kabarebe, advising the president. So you can see that what was the intention of going to Congo, it was not peaceful. They went there, they killed, according to that mapping report, they killed the women, kids, and the elderly. More than 300, I don't know, I think 300,000. You know, when they invaded those, destroyed those camps, and they forced the majority of others to come back to Rwanda. And when they came back, the way they were treated, the majority of the men were arrested, they were put in jail. Those are the ones who were released during Kachacha.
Mm.
Because the majority of them, they were called genociders. Like now, as you see in Congo, they talk about the FDRL, which is the... So you think a person, majority of the FDRL members, even including the founders, they are in Rwanda. They're working with the Kagame.
Mm-hmm.
And the other they managed to bring, they are recruiting them and taking them back to Congo to fight alongside the so-called M23. Which are the government is Rwandan soldiers there. So why? It was the first intention, because of the war was finished and Rwanda was empty, everything was destroyed. So the only reason why we had to go to Congo is to force those to destroy those refugee camps and also to use the Congo because it had minerals so that we can route that mineral and come and rebuild Rwanda.
So you obviously,
which is going on even now today.
The decision for you to refuse meant that you couldn't stay in Rwanda.
I couldn't go to fight in Congo. There was no reason to me why I should go to fight in Congo and kill people, like the way they did in that mapping report, the UN report.
You then embarked on a journey to come to South Africa. It took you a while. Was it 6 months that it took you to get?
Yes, it took me 6 months, yes. Yeah.
Mm. What did you think South Africa was going to offer you?
Actually, I didn't come straight to South Africa. I stayed in Tanzania, stayed in Malawi. Yes. I was shifting. And because of the brutality of the government, the military regime in Rwanda, where all the embassies of Rwanda, where they are, as we speak, those are not embassies. Those are military operation centers. You will see, you can count how many people have died in these neighboring countries of Rwanda, including here in South Africa. In one of the cases, I was shocked when Sophie Mukwena didn't ask Kagame when Kagame told in that interview, I don't know whether you saw it on SABC.
Yes, I did, yeah.
When he said that South Africa does not have evidence to people, he didn't even mention his own head of intelligence, whom he murdered during the daytime. I was shocked why, when he said that South Africa doesn't have evidence who killed Patrick. But Mokwena and Sophie know very well that South Africa the extradition request of three people whom the court here found that they killed Patrick. And these are military officers in Rwanda. But I was shocked to see Kagame telling Sophie that there is no evidence. I was expecting Sophie to ask him if he doesn't know that South Africa requested him. There is an extradition request from the Department of Justice here.
They did discover that you were here. How did you survive that?
Well, how many times they have attempted on my life? How many times they have... even now, as we speak, at the embassy and the agents here, whom they are using, they are listening. They know that I'm not keeping quiet with regard to the repression and the brutality and the freedom of the Rwandese and the civil political rights of the Rwandese does not exist. So I have been criticizing them, the way they have been treating the citizens, especially this, because the Rwandese rule, on the face of it, you can think that it is a normal country, but this is a country which is ruled by junta, like North Korea. The parliament, the so-called parliament, they rubber stamp what the military council, which is chaired by General Kagame, what they take a decision, and they take that decision and they give it to the parliament and the local leaders to implement.
So
every 10 houses in Rwanda, they have got a section of 12 soldiers guarding them.
So your motivation to keep speaking this way, to advocate for others like yourselves, where does that come from?
It comes because I think Rwandans have went through a lot. We deserve to not to be ruled militarily. To have a person to rule in one country for 30 years, the gentleman has been ruling, that general who is ruling Rwanda has ruled Rwanda from 1994. How many presidents South Africa has been having since 1994? How many presidents in America? I saw yesterday he was sitting with Bill Clinton.
Yes.
How many presidents came after Bill Clinton? Bill Clinton was in 2000, I think he left in 2007, after two terms. This gentleman, now he tells the people that there is no one who can rule Rwanda, only him. He's a safeguard of the Tutsis. If he can overpower the Tutsis, will be killed by Hutus. Which means he has done nothing to reconcile Rwandese in 30 years. That's why he's waging wars around the whole region. churches, the border of Burundi is closed. Why? Because he wanted to overthrow the government of Burundi. Uganda, 4 years, they just opened recently here the border after the intervention of the son of the president, General Muhoozi. He went to Rwanda and he begged him to open the border. But why? Because of interfering in Uganda. So the whole region, there is no friendly country in the region.
You hear now, and as you are saying, you know, you are speaking up and you fear for your life. What's your dream for Rwanda as we speak?
To be a free nation like any other democratic country, like here, like in Europe, like Tanzania, like Kenya, where people can choose their leaders. People can express their feelings. People can demonstrate. People can do small things. Like there is no journalism in Rwanda. Majority of them, they ran away. There is no international human rights organization. They have been closed down. Majority, they are operating from Kenya. They have chased them away. Your human rights watch, your Amnesty International, you know. If there is no political party in Rwanda, there is only one party, one the country belongs to one man and his generals. Do you know that this gentleman is one of the richest gentlemen, I mean president on the continent? Do you know that? Have you checked the Forbes? He's the wealth is about 1 billion. Where did he get in the land, small land, locked country, the country which came from genocide? Where did he get that money if they are not just rooting the country?
We're going to have to leave it there. I really appreciate you giving us time as we look at 30 years after the genocide in Rwanda. Kennedy Gihana is a human rights lawyer and Rwandan genocide survivor. As I said, he is a human rights lawyer here in South Africa.
If you missed it live, catch the broadcast on kaya959.co.za.